You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox.
Each week, we bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually healthy. And with each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we have both been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this a better place for all of us.
And we will continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is a good one. It's responsibility. And you know, it's funny. It seems like this has become a cuss word in our culture. We've got politicians that tell us that it's not their responsibility, and they blurt out things like, well, the other party did this to us. We have talking heads in the media that don't hold, quote, their party accountable, while at the same time spinning stories to their most negative conclusion against those they disagree with. And this is what our children see and read every day. It's no wonder we have higher rates of depression and dissatisfaction in this country since the Great Depression. Now, our guest today has outlined in his new book, Responsible, five key areas where we can and need to become more responsible in. And it starts right here with each of us and our families. Now, our guest today is best-selling author Matthew Hagee. Matthew is the sixth generation to carry the mantle of gospel ministry in his family and the proud son of John Hagee, founder and senior pastor of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas.
Now, Matthew, who began preaching at age 17, is a graduate of Oral Roberts University and currently serves as executive pastor of the 20,000-member-plus Cornerstone Church. He is also the host of a popular television program, The Difference, an overseas production at GETV, which includes four networks, seen weekly in more than 92 million homes. And he manages to do all of this while remaining a totally devoted husband to his wife, Kendall, and father to his three children.
Well, Matthew, welcome back to Answers for the Family.
Alan, Melody, it's a joy to be with you again, and thank you so much for this opportunity to visit with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you so much. We're thrilled to have you. And I just wanted to point out I really enjoyed your book. You have a lot of great tips in here. And although I notice, you know, it's geared towards Christians and younger Christians, you could take a lot out of this no matter what faith you come from.
Absolutely. Principles are principles, and it really has no bearing on your position in faith. Common sense will work in resolving most situations and solutions, and so I think that when you get to the underlying theme of everyone's desires and wishes, they want to live a healthy life, they want to enjoy the good and avoid the bad, and principles will help you do that.
Well, Matthew, I mean, following your first book, Shaken, Not Shattered, how did you come up with the title and why, as far as Responsible?
Well, the first book, Shaken, Not Shattered, was a concept of how to explain to the reader that even if you are living in an environment that you're not familiar with, at some point in history and at someone else's stage in life, they endured a problem similar to what you're facing. And the reason I chose to take that route in my first work was because I had visited with a number of young people, young families, young professionals that were making statements that I considered to be terribly discouraging and disparaging, saying, you know what, it's the end of the world. It's something that we're never going to recover from. And this was during a season when, they called it the economic 777 crash in the stock market, and all of these, negative things were starting to take place. as, you know, economic bubbles were bursting and opportunities were dissolving and people began to live kind of in a fearful life. And I said, look, guys, we might be shaken, but we're not shattered. We can stand firm even if the world around us falls apart. And so that was the concept of the first book. The second book, Response Able, is a combination of two words that the subtitle to the book is Lessons That My Father Has Taught Me About Life and Making a Difference. And the concept comes from a statement that he has always shared with me in my life, and that is, son, you may not be the individual responsible, but you always are able to respond. You are the person who chooses how you will behave, and no one else can dictate that to you or for you. And so in considering that thought, and something that I've always been held to as a standard in my life because of the way that I was raised in my father's home, I felt that it was important to help people understand, no, you may not be responsible for the current economy, but you're able to respond to the economy that you live in. And you may not be responsible for the behavior that your neighbor demonstrates that is culturally and morally depraved, but you are able to respond to their behavior and not allow it to impact you or impact your children and how they see right from wrong. And so I decided that it was important to apply that thought that you are always able to respond to five areas: the personal areas of your individual life, the social areas of life where you impact the community around you, and discussing several ways that I believe people of faith have really relied on the government to do more than the government was ever intended to do. And then with that comes some financial responsibility, educational responsibility, and then last but not least, political responsibility, that we all have responses that we are able to make, that if we utilize solid principles and behave properly, in spite of the current circumstance that we face, we can turn things around and make this nation, make this community, make your home, make your family, make your finances, any area of life that you want to apply these principles, you can make it better.
And what I really like is you broke down the word responsibility to response ability. So also showing that you have the ability to respond how you choose.
Absolutely. You know, the responsibility gets thrown around quite a bit, but when you break it down, it's a pretty simple definition. You're the one that makes the decision.
Yeah, and then at this point, I was having read both books. It appeared to me that your new book is almost a roadmap to recovery. In other words, if we take responsibility, if we collectively take responsibility, this really can be a roadmap to a recovery on so many levels.
I sincerely hope that it's viewed in such a light, and I appreciate you mentioning that, because if I was to start a conversation right now in an airport with a stranger, and we were to talk about what we want to change, the first thing that we would discuss would probably be the government, because we can always disagree with what political decisions are being made. Those are easy to kind of rant and rave about. And probably the last thing that we would talk about is that I would tell a stranger the things I want to change in me. Well, as you talk about a roadmap to recovery, this manuscript and the book, the way it's laid out, breaks down for the individual that if you really are sincere about trying to change the government that you currently live under, it begins with changing you. Mm-hmm. And if you are willing to change you, then you can positively impact those around you. And if you positively impact those around you, you can then effectively change the future. And if you can change the future, you can change the government. And so it takes you through that process, but it always starts with the individual and then builds that roadmap. If you were, to kind of go to that big map that you see in the mall with the little red dot that says you are here. Well, as much as you might want to get across the mall to the store that you like, it begins with you deciding to take the steps to get where you need to go.
Right, exactly. And in the first section, you talk about how you are always able to respond, and you go through seven lessons of personal responsibility. Can you touch on those a little bit?
Absolutely. The sections of the book, as you mentioned, are broken down into seven areas that each and every individual can implement. And the first lesson that I think is something that needs to be reiterated time and time again is the value of principle and responding to principle instead of passion. A lot of times people make passionate responses, and they sound good, and they've got a lot of enthusiasm behind them, but they're pretty shallow. I respond because I'm currently upset about what I'm seeing, and I want to make a change. Well, that's a good speech, but now what are you going to do? And as a matter of fact, in the book, I use an illustration of a meal that I was hosted at in the home of one of my church members, and something took place that I won't soon forget, and that's simply we had a wonderful time. The dinner was great, and we went and sat down in the living room, and the father of the family and I began to have a discussion, and it took a little while, and I heard a dish break in the kitchen. Well, when the dish broke, the husband kind of tensed up, and then he exhaled, and he said, "My wife broke the dish." And I simply said, "Well, how do you know?" And he said, "Because she's not yelling at the kids." And I thought to myself as I was driving home that night, I thought, you know, what a strange statement. Because if breaking the dish was a principal problem, then it didn't matter who broke the dish. It should have been addressed as a problem.
Right.
But since breaking the dish was a matter of passion for the mother, if the child broke the dish, she would yell at the kid. Mm-hmm. When she broke the dish, it's okay. And so I began to kind of consider, how many areas of life do we tell people, you shouldn't do that, because we're passionate about their wrongs, but we don't have any principal reason for feeling that way. Mm-hmm. And if we respond only on our passions, we change moment to moment and don't ever really get anything progressively done. If you will make a plan based on your principles and then add to it passion, you now have a powerful combination that enables you to find the fuel that you need to inspire others, create a cause and bring them to it, start a movement, and that movement creates progress, and that progress creates change. Mm-hmm. But until that takes place, you're just going to find yourself chasing fireflies, or, you know, running down rabbit trails. Any illustration you want to use for running in circles, it's going to be a problem. Another one of the seven lessons that are addressed in the first section of the book is to declare war on status quo. And if there's anything that my father has taught me simply through observation, and even the cover of the book kind of communicates the message that he and I are walking together, because I was not told what to do in my life. I was shown what to do. We often hear that old acronym, practice what you preach, or the alliteration, practice what you preach. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that I had a father who did that. Mm-hmm. If he said it, he lived it. And therefore, I was able to see the benefits of the decisions that he made in his life. But when it comes to declaring war on status quo, my father would always tell me, son, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And it was simply that there was always the need for the individual to do the absolute best job that they could do. As long as you did your absolute best, then that was all that was required of you. But if you gave less than that, then you could have done more. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I put this particular lesson into personal responsibility is because, unfortunately, I see a lot of people in a lot of places of influence and importance deciding that good is good enough. And that status quo is what it needs to be. And I think we get a lot of this from areas of education, where we want to standardize things and we want to do anything we can to take the standout and bring him back to par. And, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of places that you see this playing out. However, if you really want to be someone who's noticed in life, if the world is 5 foot, just be 5 foot two. And if you're 2 inches taller than everybody else around you, you've distinguished yourself somewhat. And so as it comes to personal responsibility, it doesn't matter what you're enduring or what you're going through. If you will declare war on status quo and say, every day I'm going to give my absolute best effort to make sure that I live a life of excellence and execute well, you'll see a lot of change being made in every area of your life, in your job, in your family, in your relationships. I have young people come and see me all the time that say, you know, Pastor, I wanted to start a career, and their aspirations are far and wide, medicine, engineering, you name it. And unfortunately, in this current economy, those opportunities are not available. And I've been very clear to tell them, whatever job you get, do it with excellence. And I assure you that opportunity will find you. If all you do is clock in and clock out, then all you'll get is a paycheck, and whenever the next person comes along, they'll replace you with them. But if you will distinguish yourself, if you will declare war on status quo, then something will open up and you will find an opportunity that you never even dreamed of. And time again, you see that played out when people are willing to do a little bit more than it's expected. There's several other principles that play out here in regards to personal responsibility. Thankfulness, you know, be thankful for today and prepared for tomorrow. Generously invest in the lives of others. And something that I think is important to consider, too, is that you may lose the battle, but you don't have to lose the war.
Exactly.
Every day is a challenge in some way. And there may be days where, you know, Pastor, my father, I refer to him as Pastor because he's played that role in my life as well. But he would often say to me, son, some days you get the bear and some days the bear gets you. And it was his way of saying, you're not going to win every day you get out of bed, but make sure you get out of bed the day after you lose. And, you know, again, a lot of times people will allow a personal tragedy. They'll allow a simple failure. They will allow something that did not go as planned to redefine them. And I believe that the fastest way to succeed is not allow failure to define you, but redefine failure as a stepping stone on your way to success. These are just a few of those seven principles that are found in personal responsibility, but right. All of it, again, as you say, a roadmap to enabling someone to change their current outcome.
Exactly. And when you talk about personal responsibility, going over those steps as a parent, that is so important to be personally responsible and to live your life, not just talk what you want, but live it.
Absolutely. I have three children. I'm blessed with a 6-year-old girl, a 4-year-old son, and a 2-year-old son. I have the daily challenge of demonstrating what I am trying to teach them, because observation is the greatest object lesson that they'll ever have. And if they hear me say it but don't see me do it, it's as if I said nothing at all. If they watch me live it, then it makes an impact and they start to implement it. And even to the point that my 2-year-old son, when I'm holding him in my arms and I walk up to someone, if I extend my hand to shake their hand in greeting, he mimics that. He extends his hand and shakes his hand and wants to shake their hand for greeting. Now, he doesn't understand that this is customary courtesy. He just sees me do it, so he sees that is the way for him to behave. Now, that may sound very simple, but it gives you how a child absorbs and learns and begins to behave and interact with others. If I don't treat someone with that kind of courtesy, he won't learn about courtesy in his life. And, you know, as I say, it's elementary on some level, but it demonstrates yet again the power of practicing what you preach and living a life of principle.
Right, and doing your best that you can every single day, which I think is so important to do. And what I really like about your book, and I was reading over it, it's more than just reading a book. You actually take people through the steps and get them to stop and consider different things. You ask questions. You have kind of like a worksheet in every chapter so people could actually ponder this and think about it and how can they apply it to their own life.
You know, one of the greatest compliments, I think, for any author is when there's lots of extra material written in the margins. If what I have written has caused a reaction, then it's impacting someone. And so I placed in the book a place for everyone to sit down and just ask themselves some self-reflecting questions that enable them to take the information and apply it personally. And through that personal application, either consider areas that they need to work on or things that they even need to implement because they haven't considered them before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And there are so many things that we can do from the standpoint of personal responsibility. And I want to make sure we get a chance to cover all of the areas. So tell us a little bit more about what we can do to accept more of our social responsibility.
Well, you know, social responsibility, I believe, is the roadmap that you need to change the world around you. And the first thing that I address in social responsibility is something that everyone who's ever had a computer problem is familiar with, and that's a reboot. And the section is called Putting Things Back in Place. But this is a lesson that came to me one day as I was having a very hostile discussion with my computer. And I know that some people speak computer language, but whatever language my computer speaks, I have no knowledge of. And so when I have a problem with my computer, I call the IT expert that's down the hall, and they come to my office and spend some time working on my computer. But I notice that they have this one step that they do before they do anything else. And that is they walk up to my computer, they turn it off, they look at their watch for about 5 seconds, they turn it back on, and see if that didn't solve the problem. One day, it just bothered me to no end that that was all that was required to fix it. And so I, smart aleck tone said, is that what I pay you for, to turn it off and turn it on? They said, well, no, you know, I mean, it's a reboot. It's what's needed. And I said, what is it about a reboot that works? And this is a lesson that was worth its weight in gold. My IT engineer looked at me and said, you sent too many signals to the computer. You told it to open one thing and close another. You told it to print and delete. You told it to edit and build. You just gave it so much information that it got confused about what you really wanted, and therefore it just froze. It locked up. And the only way to get it back to its original settings is to turn it off, allow it to reboot itself, and get back in place. And I thought, how well does that describe society? How much of life is a mixed signal? We speak about chastity, and yet the wardrobe promotes anything but a chaste lifestyle. We talk about respect, and yet we disrespect the individuals that we're supposed to be respecting. We tell a young person that they need to make decisions, and then we say, take time and enjoy life. And you know, it's one way one day and another way the next day, and therefore we see a societal gridlock that seems to cause people not to take any action because they're confused about what is the right and what is the wrong action. Mm-hmm. And so in the section of putting things back in place, I redefine what is important for society. And the first and foremost place of importance for society is the family. If you can put the family back in its proper place of priority, you can fix the rest of the problems in the nation. If you can get fathers to become the leaders that they're supposed to be in their homes, you can get individuals to see right from wrong. One of the reasons why there's a generation who's wondering what to do is because no one has told them, and the reason no one has told them is because dad is absent. You know, one of the things that I often get told by people who don't go to church is, well, I don't like to go to church because church is full of hypocrites. And my response is pretty simple. I say, we've always got room for one more. You're welcome to join us. Just come on. And it takes them aback that I would respond that way. And I tell them, I said, you know, I run a segregated church. And they kind of cross their arms and look at me like I knew you were crooked. And I say, my church is for sinners only. I said, I don't have any room for perfect people. And the reality of it is, the thing that's wrong with churches is not the buildings or the programs or the plans. The thing that's wrong with churches are the people in them. And the thing that's wrong with communities is that the churches aren't doing the things that churches should be doing. And the thing that's wrong with state government is that the communities aren't doing what communities need to be doing. And the thing that's wrong with the national government is that you've got states that are doing things that are irresponsible. Mm-hmm. So if you want to fix the big picture, you've got to fix the small picture. And that is to have things put back in their proper place. The family has got to become a place of priority. And then once that family has its place of priority, you can then, through a church organization or any other type of community work that is willing to understand what it means to live a life of sacrifice rather than selfishness, and indeed impact and make a change.
Right.
For example, if you look at the history of the church in the United States, the church had four major areas that it wanted to see a change. It wanted to have a spiritual change, it wanted to have a physical change, it wanted to have an educational change, and it wanted to have an economic change. The way that the church impacted the spiritual change was through its Sunday services. The way that it impacted the physical change was through its medical services. There's a reason why most cities have a Baptist hospital or a Methodist hospital or a hospital that's named after a Catholic patron saint. And the reason being is because while those medical facilities may be currently owned by a private organization, they were originally began by a religious organization that felt that it was important to minister to the needs of the community through medicine.
Right.
And then there was an educational situation that the church wanted to see educational change. So schools like Harvard were formed by the clergy, and places of education were developed so that individuals could come and learn the principles of a field of science or arithmetic or writing or English or history, but do that in a way that their educational efforts were created through a faith-based organization.
Right, exactly.
If you will supply education and you will supply physical welfare and you will supply emotional welfare, you can fight poverty.
Absolutely.
And so you see that, you know, until the church and the families in the church get back into their proper place of priority, you cannot reboot society.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to have to reboot this conversation in just a moment. We do have to take a commercial break, Matthew, and I really like the analogy, too, about rebooting, about how we get so confused and get so many messages that basically it's the communication that we're not allowing things to happen. But we're going to communicate right now with our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more with Matthew Hagee on Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back to more Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Dr. Melody Fox, along with Alan Cardoza. And today our guest is the author and wonderful pastor of a church of himself, Matthew Hagee. And I do love the book, Response Able. And welcome back, Matthew. And you mentioned earlier the picture on the front cover. I was going to ask if that was you and your father. I just think that's adorable.
And that's us. We were actually at a certain location taking photographs for something else, and the photographer just happened to snap that one as we were walking along the way together. And whenever we got the proofs back, I told him that's my picture. And they well, you're not even facing the camera. So that picture says more to me than anything we could ever have posed for.
Well, and that's what touched me too, is because you could feel the energy and the communication without communicating. between the two of you.
It really has a lot of symbolism to me.
Right. And we were talking before we went to the break, you know, about social responsibility. And we do have a couple listener questions, and one is regarding the word responsible. And this person writes, the word responsible as well as truth are almost forgotten in the English language. Can you tell me what we can possibly do to bring those valued traits back to future generations when we exist in a worldwide culture where our government, corporations, mainstream have been lulled into believing the ends justify the means?
Well, I think that the most effective thing that the individual can do is live and lead by example. And in doing so, you'll find that there's plenty of opportunity to reestablish principles of responsibility and truth. And if you look around, you see several areas where these changes are already taking place. There are several wonderful organizations. You know, you're there in Los Angeles in a group that I'm very familiar with and truly appreciate and love working alongside of is Matthew Barnett and the Dream Center that's taken place that's there in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they're doing is finding a need and meeting it. Well, that establishes responsibility to help others in a social atmosphere. It also shows that there is good in life, that the end does not justify the means, that the one individual counts. And so, you know, as you talk about, listen, people don't see these principles as valuable anymore. I agree with you. They do indeed hold them in low esteem and no longer have much regard for them. However, that doesn't mean that as an individual I discard them. They're still true. They're still worth living by. They're still worth implementing so that we can see not only the good of them in our life, but hopefully inspire someone else to apply them in theirs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Matthew and I, first of all, I couldn't agree more in regards to what you're saying about Matthew Barnett and the Dream Center. In fact, if you recall, that's where you and I first met.
Correct.
So, and we have a question that's come in from a listener that is also a pastor here in Los Angeles, and this one reads, I'm a pastor in a small community 100 miles east of Los Angeles. I wanted to tell you how much we appreciate your willingness to speak out on this topic and would love to hear your comments about what so many of us are doing in and outside the religious setting.
Well, I think that kind of reflects back to the previous statement that if you look around every day, you see people doing good. You see individuals that are going out of their way to share the best of themselves with others. One of the places that I see that on a daily basis is in our Christian school. We at the church have an 800-student school. And every day I see teachers interacting with students, and I see parents interacting with faculty, and I see an entire community coming together to see that the next generation gets a solid education. The quality of the student that comes out of our church school is we carry the credentials of a college preparatory school, but the reality of it is we actually went and found the requirements for the standard academic achievement tests of 1970 and said that we are going to apply these principles to our school, and we score much higher on all reading, writing, arithmetic, and science than any state educational requirement right now. What does that tell you? That after almost 40 years, greater than 40 years, the educational standard has fallen rather than risen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you are applying these principles today in your educational system, what you see is that you have a college preparatory level that used to be considered a standard academic achievement.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you're talking about a chapter in your book called Educational Responsibility.
It's an area of great need and great concern. Even if you don't have a child in school, the children who are currently in school will one day make a decision on your behalf, which is something you need to pay attention to.
Absolutely. They're the caregivers of tomorrow, and as we get older, we need them. And you know, basically be nice to the people on the way up because you'll see them on the way down too.
Absolutely. My children ask me all the time, Dad, when you're old and I'm the adult, do I have to? And I give them very clear instructions about how I plan to be cared for in my old age because I want to make sure they know that if I'm taking care of them now, I want to be taken care of later.
Absolutely. And I know that, you know, we don't have a lot of time here and I want to make sure we touch base on everything. Can you talk a little bit about financial responsibility and what you think we can do to get our families and our country out of this mess that we happen to find ourselves in?
I think the first thing that we need to do is embrace the joy of working. I know a lot of people who have jobs, but I know very few people who enjoy their work. And we need to understand that work is not a curse. Work is a blessing. God created for 6 days, and he established for man this principle. If I work, you work. I work 6 days, I rest one. You work 6 days, you rest one. And so you have a 6-to-1 ratio. There are a lot of people who say, listen, I want to be a part of an organization, a union, an association, that I'm going to work this many hours and then I get this many hours off, and I'm going to work this many days and I get this much vacation, and I'm not going to do what is needed to be done. I'm only going to do what is prearranged and agreed upon, and if you ask me to do any more than that, I'm going to consider that cruel and unusual punishment. The reason why a number of nations around the world are outproducing America is because those nations are not afraid to work. And we have a lot of people who are working. We have a lot of people who are producing. We have a lot of people who are earning. And unfairly, they are having to give up their earnings and the things that they are investing their life in to pay for people who will not embrace the joy of working. I recently had a conversation with several young people who were very upset that there wasn't any opportunity in this country, and I almost was repulsed at the attitude from which the comment came from. And I said, well, the reason that you feel that way is because you want someone to offer you a career, and you are interested in a job, but you don't want to go to work. And they looked at me and said, what do you mean? I said, if you look across the street, and we just happened to be in a strip mall, there was a Walmart across the street, and across it was a huge banner. It said, now hiring all shifts. And I said, if you really wanted opportunity, you'd walk in there, you'd pick up an application, and you'd go to work tomorrow. And I said, and then when you showed up to work, you'd demonstrate to Walmart that you were the best thing they ever hired. And I said, and if you had enough stick-to-itness and you were willing to try, you might get promoted to an executive level in that company, and someday you could run Walmart. And they rolled their eyes and said, yeah, that's a pipe dream. I said, but we live in a land with no opportunity.
So it's a great point. Now, go ahead. Anyway, we were also talking a little bit in regards to as far as the educational part. And within the educational part, you used a term that said, stop outsourcing your authority. Explain a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, that is a statement to parents. And I believe that parents who get involved in public education in many cases, and sometimes in private education, they consider the area of education to be someone else's responsibility. You are compensated, government. You are compensated, private school, to teach my child. And that's not true. You, as a parent, are the primary educator in that child's life. You teach them right from wrong. You teach them good from bad. You teach them truth from a lie. And in many cases, we have outsourced our authority. If the state says that this is what's good for our children, we immediately accept it because the state is the authority on our children. And if the teacher says this is the diagnosis of your child's behavior, we immediately accept it because the teacher has an area of expertise. I'm not suggesting that the state and the teachers in certain situations do not have qualified insight based on their levels of education. But the bottom line is, every decision that is made in the life of your child is your responsibility. You don't get to shirk any of them and say, well, they told me. No, even if they told you, you accepted what they told you. And I think it's an important thing for people to realize that their children do not belong to the state, that God gave those children to you. They belong to you. You raise them. You train them. You teach them. And whenever they become something, you take responsibility for what they become.
And what are some of the suggestions that you have to parents to take over their campus?
One of the things that you can do to take over your campus is become a source of good. One of the things that we began here at Cornerstone Church was that we encourage parents to adopt their school. For example, the state does give every teacher in the state of Texas a budget for supplies, but that certainly doesn't cover all of the cost of supplies. As many people know, teachers unfortunately do not receive often the highest compensations for the hours that they work. And so one of the things that we encouraged our parents to do was to go to their students, their children's teachers, and ask them, what can I buy for you? Can I buy you a stapler? Can I buy you a pack of pencils? Can I buy you some paper? Do you need some scissors? What are the things that you need in this classroom to better educate my child? And then go out and buy them and just give them to the teacher. Immediately, you have become a person who is helping solve a problem, not creating one. And so they get a sense and a feel for who you are. You are the person who sees a need and you meet that need. And as the year progresses, sooner or later, you're going to come to a point of conflict or difference of opinion, maybe in the curriculum, maybe in a practice, maybe in some decision that's being made on your child's behalf. And when you walk in to address that, you can address it not from a hostile position, but from an area of a concerned parent who has played a role, an active role, in the education of this child. In essence, you take over the campus. For example, in my childhood, my father was always very active in every classroom that I entered. He made a point to let the teachers know on the first day of school my name and his name and where he could be reached in case he was needed for any reason concerning me. And it gave me a great sense of confidence, but looking back, I see it was a way for him to inform the teacher, listen, he may be one of 28, but as far as I'm concerned, he's the only one. And whenever things became controversial, if you would, or if there was a situation that was taking place in the classroom, the parent or the teacher was always very preemptive to give me the opportunity to express how I felt or to ask my father's permission before or see that anything that was necessary for me to be accommodated was taken care of, simply because my father took an active role in the areas where I was being educated. Mm-hmm. For one instance, we were given an assignment in the third grade to write a story about a country from which our ancestry had come. And my mother is Hispanic, and so I chose to write about Christmas in Mexico. And a Christmas tradition in Mexico is the event called Posada, and it is where children in a village will pass from house to house in the symbolic manner of Mary and Joseph looking for a place to have the Christ child. And in the last house, they throw a party because this is the place where Christ had was symbolically born and came into the earth. So I wrote about Posada, and you cannot write about the passing, if you would, without mentioning the Christ child. When I turned in the paper, it was recommended to be read to the whole school as this was a contest that was school-wide. But the principal rejected the notion that my paper be read because in it was the word Christ child. As a third grader, I went to school. I was told I was going to read my paper. I walked into the principal's office. The principal said, I'm sorry, we cannot allow you to read this paper because you mentioned the word Christ child. As a third grader, I thought nothing of it. I turned around. I went back to my classroom. When I got home, my father asked me, son, how did your reading go today with your paper? I said, it didn't happen. He said, why not? I said, because the principal said that I wrote Christ child in the paper. Immediately, I knew something was wrong. I didn't really know what was wrong. I just knew that Dad was not happy with what I had just said. He looked at me and said, tomorrow morning, I'm taking you to school. So tomorrow morning comes, and we get in the car, and we go to school, and he gets out and walks into the principal's office. I'm sitting in the lobby. I don't know what's being said in the principal's office. All I know is that whenever that conversation is over, the principal walks out of the office, walks to the PA system, says, students, we're here to say our pledges and give the announcements, and now would you welcome third grader Matthew Hagee as he reads his paper. And she held down the microphone button while my father watched me read every line and every page of that paper. Now, here are some things that you say, well, that's an interesting encounter. In my life, that was in the third grade. And to it, I remember these things. One, My father knew enough about what was going on in my third grade world that he knew on a certain day I was to be the child to read a certain paper to the entire class. Mm-hmm. Two, he was not afraid to confront what he considered to be a wrong taken against his child by an organization. Mm-hmm. Three, whenever he walked into that principal's office, whatever decision was made on Monday had been changed on Tuesday because someone who cared about me was willing to confront it. Now, on that day, at that particular time, who was in charge of that campus? The principal or my father?
Your father.
Your father.
So you, as a parent, have the ability to take control of that campus, whether the government or the state or the school wants to admit it or not.
Mm-hmm. And talking about the state and political stuff, you also touch on political responsibility in your book. We only have a couple minutes. That's why I'm kind of moving you along. But
not a problem.
But could you...
You tell me when to be quiet. It happens all on a regular basis in my life.
Well, I can listen to you all day, but could you touch a little bit on that chapter about political responsibility?
Absolutely. I was asked recently... When I say recently, it seems recently because I think all we do is run for president these days. But in the previous presidential election, I was asked, who I was for and who was I going to support for president. And I answered that question with a very real sense of grief because I did not feel like either candidate really reflected who I was. I felt like there was a candidate who might have less of an impact on my life, and I would prefer that than someone who wants to tell me how I should live and breathe. But I didn't feel like as a Bible-believing Christian who felt that there was absolute truth, that there was right and that there was wrong, that family was sacred, I didn't feel like I had a representative. And so as I kind of pondered that, I thought, it's time for individuals to decide to form a new kind of party, not a Republican party that has a printed core system of values and yet demonstrates on a regular basis that they don't even live by the values that they've printed, not a Democratic party that in many ways is guilty of the same and yet works so diligently on its agenda instead of the welfare of the individuals and the future of the nation. But a new kind of party where an individual who is a voter, who is a taxpayer, who is a citizen of the United States says, I am going to be personally responsible to see that the government I have is the best government I can elect. I'm going to do this by informing myself about the individuals who are running and not just taking the word of the media for it, but looking at it on an individual person-by-person basis until I understand who they are, what their history demonstrates they believe, and what I believe they will do once they get into office. Mm-hmm. As an individual, I'm going to support the government by not complaining about the government that I have elected. I think it's a very hypocritical thing for a person to stand up and ridicule the government that they voted for. There's a reason why they're in office. They didn't come to it through force. They came through it by vote.
Absolutely.
And so it becomes a matter of responsibility for you to say, listen, the highest form of government is self-government. So I am going to govern myself in a way that I wish others to govern me.
Well, I think that's a great start, but this sounds to me like you're about ready to announce your candidacy.
I think I have a better job than political office. I get the opportunity to help people find the truth in God's word.
Yeah. So what you're saying is you don't want to take a demotion right now.
Demotion, promotion, I don't care for either motion. I'm just interested in helping individuals see that they have the opportunity to impact change on so many levels that the only question they really need to answer is, when do you want to get started?
Absolutely. Now, if people want your book, where do they go find it?
They can find the book at our ministry website, which is jhm.org. They can find it at a microsite, which is responsablethebook.org. If they go to the microsite, responsablethebook.org, they can get a free download of the first chapter, and if they enjoy reading that, they can find the book at any place that books are sold, on Amazon, and in any format that books are currently available.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew, I want to thank you. I wish that we weren't out of time. I appreciate you coming on now for the second time, and I just want to tell everybody out there that I am very impressed with the book, and I strongly suggest that you read it, and not just yourselves, but ask your teens to read it as well. One of my favorite parts of the book is the connection between gratitude and responsibility. What a great message to pass along to the next generation. Mm-hmm. Matthew, thank you so much, and for everybody else out there, I appreciate your listening.
And don't forget,
Alan, Dr. Melody, thank you so much for the opportunity, and I look forward to visiting with you again soon.
Well, thank you very much. Our guest today, Matthew Hagee, part of the Gospel Ministry, the whole Hagee family, and executive pastor of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas. Thanks so much for joining us again on Answers for the Family. And if you want more information, just go to our website, answers4thefamilyblog.com, and we will talk to you next time. Take care.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.